Hi folks, Oisin here. Before we get into the podcast, I want to give a quick shout out to Sarah and her podcast called Let's Talk About Sex. It's a podcast where each episode is devoted to a different cult and how they operate. Definitely one to recommend for fans of all things cult related. Here's her promo.
Hi, I'm Sarah Steele and I host a podcast called Let's Talk About Sex. I look at a different cult each episode, examining the group's leadership, beliefs, recruitment methods, member experiences, and any notable incidents during its existence. It's a monthly podcast with a heavily researched, deep dive storytelling style. That's Let's Talk About Sects, and the website is ltaspod.com for all your podcast provider links. Hope you'll have a listen.
Again, I just want to say thanks to everyone for your shares, reviews, and contributions. It's really helping to grow the listenership of this podcast and giving me more time to research more episodes. If you'd like to donate the price of a coffee or pint, you can do so over at patreon.com/thetroublespodcast. Now, back to the episode. It was rush hour on Friday evening in Dublin City. Traffic was heavy, and because of a bus strike, there was a lot more people milling about the streets, heading home from work. At 28 minutes past 5, the first bomb exploded and caused utter devastation on Parnell Street. Then, 2 minutes later, a second bomb went off on Talbot Street. 2 minutes after that, a third bomb exploded. These three bombs all exploded within the space of 6 minutes and caused absolute chaos on the streets of Dublin. A fourth bomb then exploded in the county of Monaghan, 90 minutes later. These four bombings are responsible for the single deadliest death toll in the conflict known as the Troubles. And today, over 40 years later, there are still many aspects of this attack which are shrouded in mystery. This is the Troubles Podcast. A podcast which explores the violence and bloodshed that occurred in Northern Ireland, the Republic of Ireland, and Great Britain, as multiple sides and organisations waged a conflict over the status of Northern Ireland. Just a quick warning before we begin that this episode contains some content which may not be suitable for a younger audience. The early 70s in Northern Ireland saw a dramatic rise in violence. But down south, in the Republic, the people were well aware of the violence that was going on across the border. But, to put it bluntly, most of them had other things on their mind. Cost of living, the threat of strikes and unemployment trumped issues in Northern Ireland for the majority of people in the Republic. Of a poll done in 1969, 70% of Irish people believed that Northern Ireland should be allowed to solve its own problems, and only 19% believed that the Irish government should intervene more. In particular, the people of Dublin were seen to be the most non-interventionist in the entire country. As the violence escalated up north, the attitudes down in the Republic began to change. Upon hearing stories of Catholics burnt out of their homes and innocent people being arrested, a small but devout movement grew in the south. With a variety of aims, including raising money to fund the IRA, as well as locating guns to arm them. Members of the IRA and Sinn Féin would campaign for funds in the south and speak at rallies around the country. There have even been accounts of IRA members going from door to door and pub to pub trying to raise funds. There were marches all over the country, and different groups soon began to campaign for the Catholics in the six counties, which was what some Republicans referred to as Northern Ireland. As the violence increased in the 70s, many people in the Republic began to see a constant stream of soldiers attacking civilians on their televisions. Then, when Bloody Sunday happened in 1972, there was outrage in the Republic. There were massive protests all over the country, and in Dublin, an angry crowd gathered outside the British Embassy over a number of days to protest the killings. Eventually, the embassy was burned down, while the Dublin Fire Brigade watched on, and would only intervene if the fire spread to any other buildings. Many people believed that Ireland was on the brink of civil war. Journalist John Healy said, quote, "Little by little, the pus from the running wound of the Northern crisis seeps into our affairs." This violence began to seep down into the Republic in 1969, when Loyalists began a campaign of attacking strategic locations around Ireland. Statues were bombed in Dublin, as well as power stations, railway lines, and even the headquarters of the Irish National Broadcaster, RTE. For the most part, these attacks caused structural damage and there was very few casualties. Things began ramping up in 1971 and 72 as letter bombs were sent to the homes of Irish Republicans. As well as that, there were a number of incendiary devices planted in department stores and hotels in Monaghan, Dublin and Donegal. Towards the end of 1972, the attacks intensified and civilians began to lose their lives as a result of car bombs. But no one in the Republic was prepared for the sheer scale of what would come next. It was May 1974 in Northern Ireland, and after years of violence, an attempt at peace was made in the form of the proposed Sunningdale Agreement. This agreement was an attempt at establishing a power-sharing executive in Northern Ireland, which would also allow the Republic of Ireland to have an advisory role in as well. Unionists in Northern Ireland were fiercely opposed to this. They did not want to share power with nationalists in Northern Ireland and were appalled at the idea that the Republic of Ireland would have a say in their affairs. To combat this agreement, a general strike was called on the 15th of May, which proved to be very successful. Northern Ireland was brought to a standstill, and as many of the strikers worked in power plants, most of Northern Ireland's electricity supply was cut off. Loyalist paramilitary organisations also took part in the strike, intimidating workers and preventing them from going to work. The people in the Republic watched on, completely unaware that there was a plot underway to attack Ireland's capital city, Dublin. Prior to this point, the car bomb was the weapon of choice by the IRA in Belfast. Car bombs could cause a massive amount of damage if they were filled with explosives, and they were also rather inconspicuous. Loyalist groups were responsible for approximately 5-10% of car bombs in 1973 and 74. But the vast majority of car bombs were planted by the IRA in Belfast. This is another reason why the attack in Dublin was so unexpected. It was a Friday evening in Dublin City on the 17th of May 1974. Many people were out on the street heading home from work. There was a general bus strike on, so the streets were more crowded than usual and traffic was also heavier. At 28 minutes past 5 on Parnell Street, the first bomb exploded. It was a car bomb, which was parked in the loading bay outside Barry's supermarket on the busy street. One survivor described the explosion, saying it was like, quote, "a big ball of flame coming straight towards us, like a great nuclear mushroom cloud whooshing up everything in its path. Windows of shops were blown out and nearby cars were flipped over from the explosion, and anyone who was even remotely near the bomb was killed instantly. In total, 10 people were killed in this first explosion, with many more severely injured." 15-year-old ambulance volunteer Esma Crabb described the scene as she came across a man motionless on the street. Quote, "I took his pulse and he was dead. Then I was called to a man covered by a plank. When I lifted it up, one of his legs was missing and lying nearby. One side of his head was completely ripped away and was lying on the ground. A child, aged 12, lay nearby. At the scene, there were bodies all over the place. Many people were in deep shock and there were terrible injuries." The shock from the explosion had barely set in when less than 2 minutes later, there was a second explosion on Talbot Street, which runs parallel to Parnell Street and was essentially just around the corner. This street was the main route from the city centre to Connolly Station, one of the main train stations in Dublin. So it was densely packed with people when the bomb exploded. A quote from the Barron report reads, "Seconds after the blasts, as the pall of smoke rose from the streets, dazed survivors saw the normal home-going rush of people turned into a scene of carnage. There were bodies, some limbless, some blasted beyond recognition, some burned, lying in the pavements. Scores of others, badly injured and many knocked out by the blast or shocked by the impact, were hurled into windows and side streets. For some time, it was impossible to distinguish between the dead and the injured." Anesthesiologist Dr. John Cooper was at the scene and said, "The scene was horrifying. I ran back to see a woman on the pavement decapitated. Another woman lay dead with a piece of car engine embedded in her back. A man was dying with an iron bar through his abdomen." The rescue efforts were hampered by the bad traffic, and as a result, some bodies lay in the street for up to half an hour as ambulances rushed to the scene. People at the scene covered them in newspapers while two priests walked around delivering last rites to the dead. 12 people were killed in this blast, with another two who would later pass away from their injuries. Here's an account from Bernie, who was caught up in the blast and lost an eye.
There was a big flash in the sky and I looked up and I thought, it's probably thunder. But I didn't get time to think anymore because with that, the windows and everything came in, the other bomb had exploded.
2 minutes later, at 5:32, a third bomb exploded in the city. This one was in the form of another car bomb and exploded near Trinity College on South Leinster Street. Two women were killed outright from this blast. Dental students from the nearby Trinity College rushed to attend the injured. Another witness described the scene at one of the bombings.
A young girl just walking along the middle, you know, on the pathway. When the explosion happened, it must have thrown the door out because she went smash-bang against the wall. Then police and ambulance came flying around the place. And when they got to the girl, they picked up what was left of her body and put it onto the stretcher. They had to wrap it up in three blankets so people wouldn't see what was happening.
The devastation caused by these three bombings was very large, but it wasn't over yet. 90 minutes after the first bomb exploded in Dublin, there was another explosion in Monaghan town, which was a short distance from the border to Northern Ireland. It was a car bomb parked in the centre of the town. Five people were killed instantly in the blast, with another two to pass away in the following weeks. In total, 34 people were killed in the Dublin-Monaghan bombings, with most of the victims being women, as well as two infant girls and a World War I veteran. In the immediate aftermath, Dublin City was a scene of chaos. All of the hospitals were told to prepare for the arrival of the wounded and dead, and the blood bank in Pelican House became overflowed with people who wanted to donate their blood and help the victims. Many of the injured were bundled into cars and rushed to hospitals because the ambulances were stuck in the heavy traffic. In some cases, surgeons were brought directly to the scene to attend to the wounded. One individual, Paddy Doyle, lost his daughter, son-in-law and two baby granddaughters in the bombings. Paddy later described what it was like in the hospital morgue. Quote, "I don't think I'm really the same ever since that. I think it was the scenery in the morgue. I think that really knocked a bit out of me, you know. It was like going into a slaughterhouse. Bits of bodies everywhere. I identified the son-in-law and the two kids, but the daughter, I couldn't place her. But it was an awful sight to go into. When you went in, you had to step over legs and arms, where they were putting legs and arms just to make up a body." Another survivor was 4-year-old Edward O'Neill. He was with his brother, 6-year-old Billy, and father, who was also named Edward. Billy was getting a haircut as his communion was the following day. And in the blast, Edward Sr. was killed instantly. Billy had bent over to pick up a button off the ground and was spared from the full impact of the bomb, though he was seriously injured. 4-year-old Edward suffered life-altering injuries in the blast, which included pieces of shrapnel being embedded in his face and head. Later that evening, Gardaí cordoned off the area and the investigation began. They also set up a number of national cordons, stopping public transport to try and prevent the bombers from leaving the country. It wasn't long before the Loyalist paramilitary group, the Ulster Defence Association, would become the main suspect in these attacks. A phone call had been placed to Irish News and the Irish Times, where a man named Captain Craig claimed responsibility for the attacks and attributed them to the group the Red Hand Brigade, which was believed to be a cover name. The Ulster Defence Association, or UDA for short, were officially formed in 1971 and were an umbrella group for a number of different loyalist groups. They were responsible for more than 400 deaths during the Troubles, most of which were Catholic civilians who were killed in retaliatory attacks for IRA actions on Protestants. In Northern Ireland, the press secretary for the UDA, Sammy Smith, said of the bombings, quote, "I am very happy about the bombings in Dublin. There's a war with the Free State and now we are laughing at them." Fred Cobain of the Ulster Unionist Party remarked, "It was only a matter of time before loyalists went south. Dublin is having an increasing say in the affairs of Northern Ireland. The way to reverse that trend is to indulge in the same tactics as the IRA and to attack targets in the south. This may be a sign of things to come." Both Irish and British governments condemned the attacks, and the Irish government committed to finding out exactly who was responsible. That being said, they also came under an immense amount of criticism for refusing to have a day of mourning for the victims, and they also initially refused to fly the Irish flag at half-mast in government buildings, but this decision was soon reversed. Strangely enough, for many people living in the Republic, the bombing fueled opinions against the Provisional IRA themselves, believing that the IRA's bombing campaign in Northern Ireland and Great Britain to be the reason why loyalists had targeted Dublin and Monaghan. Taoiseach Liam Cosgrave said of the bombing, "The blood of the innocent victims of last Friday's outrage and the victims of similar outrages in the North and in England is on the hands of every man who has fired a gun or discharged a bomb in furtherance of the present campaign of violence on these islands. Just as plainly as it is on the hands of those who parked the cars and set the charges last Friday. In our times, violence cannot be contained in neat compartments and justified in one case but not in another." British journalist Gillian Linscott wrote that while few people in Dublin doubt that the bombings were the work of loyalists, there was no sign of sectarianism bitterness. For most people, the deaths were seen as personal and family tragedies, not as political martyrdoms. When it came down to the investigation, very little progress was made. In 1974, there was no dedicated forensic lab in Ireland at the time, though samples from the crime scene had been taken to the state laboratory, but they were badly handled and not properly collected. The branch investigating the Monaghan bombing did receive some information from the Northern Irish Police Force, the RUC, which linked a number of individuals to the attack, and by the end of 1974, little had been done. By 1976, there were still no arrests and the government seems to have given up on the investigation. It wasn't until 15 years later. It wasn't until in 1993 when a British documentary raised some controversial questions and revealed more details regarding the investigation that had occurred. The Hidden Hand was a Yorkshire television broadcast which brought the Dublin Monaghan bombings to the forefront once again. The documentary explained a fairly detailed timeline of what happened on the day of the attack. On the 17th of May 1974, two cars were hijacked from the Protestant Shankill area of Belfast, and a third car was stolen. They were then driven to an isolated farmhouse in South Armagh, where the bombs would then be loaded into the cars. The three cars were then driven down to Dublin separately, before gathering in a car park on the outskirts of Dublin, before separating and being planted on the three streets. The bombs were then armed and the perpetrators disappeared. That same afternoon, another car was stolen in Portadown, and driven to a farmhouse where a bomb was loaded into it. The car then drove to Monaghan town with a getaway vehicle following behind. The car was parked in the centre of the town and the bomber escaped in the getaway vehicle. There is a theory that the bombing in Monaghan was designed to be a distraction to the local Gardaí, who would be drawn to the scene. This would allow the loyalists who committed the Dublin bombing to escape across the border into Northern Ireland without the risk of a checkpoint. During the bomber's route, multiple eyewitnesses spotted the bomb cars and the drivers on their way to Dublin and in and around the city itself. These witnesses were then shown official police photos where a list of suspects was drawn up, 8 in total. All the men identified were members of the UVF, and 2 were identified as looking very similar to the drivers of the bomb cars. Those 2 were David Alexander Mulholland and Samuel Whitten, and they were both identified by 3 separate eyewitnesses. Based on their intelligence in Northern Ireland, the Gardaí then drew up a list of loyalists who were then named as being planners involved in the attacks. They were Billy Hanna, Harris Boyle, and Robin Jackson, who at the time was known as the Jackal. There was also a 4th planner revealed by the documentary, who was known as Robert McConnell. The 4 had previously served in the Ulster Defence Regiment, or UDR, which was a legal Northern Irish regiment of the British Army, not to be confused with the paramilitary UDA. Though many loyalist paramilitaries would join the UDR so that they could learn how to use weapons or find the locations of British Army weapons caches. The documentary then revealed that the Gardaí, armed with their new intelligence, then headed up to Northern Ireland in an attempt to work with the RUC to identify and interview over 20 suspects. At the beginning of this operation, their communication with the RUC went very well, but once they went into Northern Ireland, they were met with a wall of silence. Instead of being allowed to interview their list of suspects, they had to hand over their information to the RUC and wait. It's important to remember that the RUC at this stage were a primarily Protestant force, and many had little to no interest in working with the Irish Gardaí. One Garda believed that there was a deliberate policy of the RUC not to help the inquiry, and that someone higher up the chain of command was making the RUC act that way. The documentary confirmed that the RUC had done their own investigation and had a list of UVF suspects that was the same as the Gardaí. RUC officers reported this list to RUC headquarters, but they were never asked to follow up or arrest any suspects. With nowhere to turn to, the Gardaí returned to Ireland and the investigation was quietly wound down after only 3 months. They would later receive a large amount of criticism for winding down this investigation so quickly and not following up on potential leads. The focus of both investigations led detectives to the northern Irish town of Portadown, a loyalist stronghold and place where the Mid-Ulster Brigade operated, who were a notorious part of the UVF. For anyone who listened to the episode on Cross Maglen last week, which was a notorious Republican stronghold, Portadown would be the equivalent, but on the loyalist side. Captain Fred Holroyd was a military intelligence officer for the British Army from 1973 to 1975, and spent 1974 working undercover in Portadown. While there, he was in contact with many of the people suspected of taking part in the bombing. He was interviewed for the documentary, where he claimed that the bombing was not characteristic of any previous attacks by the UVF. Holroyd raised a number of points in the documentary. First, the bombing itself was quite sophisticated. The three bombs planted in Dublin had exploded within 6 minutes of each other. Prior to this point, the Loyalists' bomb-making skills had been more rudimentary, involving black powder fuses. They had never exploded three bombs in synchronization before or after this attack. Another point raised in the documentary was that the bombs themselves were extremely efficient and didn't leave behind any residue whatsoever, indicating that the mix in the explosive was consistent and expertly made. Intelligence played a key role in the murky nature of the investigation into this bombing. During the Troubles, there was a huge amount of undercover operatives in Loyalist and Republican organisations. The British had many undercover agents and informants who were embedded deep in Loyalist circles. The documentary then posed the question, what if some of the suspects were in fact undercover British Army soldiers? Would it be wise to blow their cover for an investigation in the Republic of Ireland? 1 week after the airing of the documentary, and 15 years after the bombings themselves, the UVF claimed responsibility for the attack, and were quick to deny any involvement of British security forces. They claimed, quote, "The entire operation was, from its conception to its successful conclusion, planned and carried out by our volunteers, aided by no outside bodies. In contrast to the scenario painted by the programme, it would have been unnecessary and indeed undesirable to compromise our volunteers' anonymity by using clandestine security force personnel, British or otherwise, to achieve an objective well within our capabilities. Given the backdrop of what was taking place in Northern Ireland when the UVF were bombing Republican targets at will, either the researchers decided to take poetic license to the limit, or the truth was being twisted by knaves to make a trap for fools. The minimum scrutiny should have revealed that the structure of the bombs placed in Dublin and Monaghan were similar, if not identical, to those being placed in Northern Ireland on an almost daily basis. The types of explosives, timing, and detonating methods all bore the hallmark of the UVF. It is incredulous that these points were lost on the Walter Mitties who conjured up this programme. To suggest that the UVF were not, or are not, capable of operating in this manner outlined in the programme is tempting fate to a dangerous degree." After mounting pressure from victims' families, an inquiry into the bombings was announced in the year 2000, which would become known as the Barron Report. The Irish government admitted that the British government was slow to release any documents relating to this case, and then in 2003, the British government announced that all documents relating to the bombing would not be made available due to national security concerns. Overall, the Barron Report made a number of findings. For one, the Gardaí investigation was criticised. The report found that the Gardaí failed to act promptly when they discovered that the attack was most likely carried out by Loyalists. As well as that, the state was found to be ill-prepared to carry out a forensic analysis of the explosions. The analysis could have established if the bombs were typical of Loyalist gangs or if they were expertly made. When it came to the relationship between the Gardaí and the RUC, the Gardaí were again criticised and the report asked why the RUC was not asked to conduct inquiries on their behalf. The inquest then went on to make the conclusion that the bombing was carried out by two groups of loyalist paramilitaries, one from Belfast and one from Portadown. The inquest went on to say that the attack was carried out to strike a blow at the Sunningdale process and may have been spurred on by a statement made from the Irish Taoiseach in April 1974, in which he expressed the hope that formal ratification of the agreement would take place in May. The involvement of British Army, UDR, RUC, or British Intelligence was not ruled out, but there was also no tangible proof that linked them to the attacks. With regard to investigating collusion, the inquiry as a whole was obstructed by British authorities. A further inquiry took place in 2005, which was called the McEntee Inquiry, which focused on the shortcomings of the Gardaí during this investigation. Both inquiries will be linked in the show notes. The families of the victims are still campaigning for justice today, and do so under the moniker Justice for the Forgotten. They continue to pressure the Irish government as well as hold memorial ceremonies for their lost ones on each anniversary of the bombing. In 2018, they accused the bombing of being airbrushed from Irish history school books. The books, which are studied by Irish teenagers, cover the Troubles but make no reference to the Dublin and Monaghan bombings, which were the single biggest bombing attack in the history of the Republic. As of writing, it has now been 46 years since the Dublin-Monaghan bombings, and no one has stood trial for the attacks. The group will continue to campaign for their loved ones so that their names will never be forgotten.